Hello, and welcome to Evaluland. This is the show where we interview people about any and all things evaluation related. I am your host, Dana Jane Linnell, recording on the ancestral lands of the Anishinaabe people in Menominee, Wisconsin.
Well, Allison Freer, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell me a little, how are you doing today?
I am doing wonderful. Thank you. Did some collaborative work earlier today with some other grad students. So lots of exciting things in evaluation happening.
Very excited. I'm kind of curious to hear. I think I know what you're talking about with the collaborative work.
You do. Yeah,
I do. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you want to talk about that because it's so in the early stages, but I'm excited for it.
Yeah. You know what? I think it is in the early stages, but it's also a group that Amanda Suter from the University of Connecticut brought us together, and we've connected with each other in different ways. And so to be able to come together and work on some ideas about like what our experience is like with research on evaluation is really what we're looking at, because at this moment, there's a call out for articles for the new directions for evaluation. And so that's part of what we're looking at. Is there something we can put together that might be a good contribution to the literature in that space?
Yeah. And I think that's a very exciting topic. And also, I put this in when I was responding to your email, what a rockstar team. Like, I love how it's people from multiple universities, multiple countries, right? Because you're in Canada, mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, I am. Yes. You're yeah. And we've got another Carolina Kaminska, who's also over here in Canada at a Canadian school. So yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So at least three universities being represented here, right? And I just love that. I'm wondering how did you all get to meet each other? Because I when I was kind of growing up in the eval space, like it was Twitter for me, but I'm curious how you all have kind of gotten connected and came together for this project.
Oh, good question. Yeah. So not Twitter or X, it's new
oh, yeah.
Iteration. No, so we actually, Amanda and I met through a case competition. So we did the Max Bell School of Public Policy Evaluation Capacity Building Case Competition led by Leslie Fierro and the team at the Evaluation Capacity Network. And we did that, the inaugural one last year, and we were on a team together. So through that case competition, you're actually placed, they choose your teams for you. And so you get to meet some new faces that you are unfamiliar with, which was wonderful. And my whole team was great, but Amanda and I really connected. And we also did the AEA case competition last year together. And then a couple of the other folks from the group, one was on that team with us, Kari Ross Nelson. And she had taken some classes in the program that I'm in at the interdisciplinary PhD in evaluation at Western Michigan University. And so I knew her through there, and another classmate from there, also Val Marshall is also in that group. And then we've got, like I said, Carolina Kaminska, who was part of the Max Bell case competition as well. And then Christine Laboon, who is actually just talking last week in AA365 a lot about her experience as a doctoral student. And then the last person that's in that group right now that may evolve is Rachel Kenny, who is like student taking courses and not fully enrolled in a PhD program. So it's really interesting to get all the different perspectives and just to connect with each other and have kind of a support network for people where we're at. Yeah.
Yeah. And especially going through that PhD process, that is definitely where support is needed, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, so I'm in Canada. I'm in Essex County, which is just across from Detroit, and I take all my classes virtually. So it's really nice to be able to build a support network, and it kind of stops me from being limited to my program because I don't have like a natural necessarily opportunities to connect with folks in the program in Kalamazoo. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, and I like even when I was at Claremont with all the we were an in-person program, like fully at the time, I still found networking outside of Claremont really beneficial because then I was just getting to know all these other people doing all this amazing, cool things. Not to say people at Claremont weren't, but like I found people a little bit more excited about some of the things that I was really excited about, you know, like, so finding that group of people that can really like support you and get excited with you about fun things is so, so helpful.
Absolutely. And I think that's what you just touched on is such an interesting part of evaluation, right? Like that there are so many different areas of interest that people have. So being able to find people who share, you know, my interest is really in evaluation capacity building and use. And so we do have some folks internally there, but we also have like there are so many other people that I can connect with and learn from. So it's cool.
Yeah. And given kind of the the nature of evaluation being in so many different disciplines and sectors and approaches and theories and methodologies and all this stuff. Like, I feel like I have multiple communities that I go to. Like I have my my research on evaluation community, my teaching of evaluation community, now this case competition community of people. And I'm sure there are others that are not coming to mind right now, but it makes it so much more enjoyable. There's just these little pockets of great human beings doing all this great work.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's so neat. And like you said about passion, like people get so passionate about their work and different aspects of their work. So it's fun to build on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear more about your experiences at Western Michigan, going back to school, starting to work on this PhD and all the things that go along with it, like the dissertation. So, you know, tell me how you got started.
Yeah, absolutely. So I did my undergrads in psych and social work. And then I worked for a little bit. I'm going way back here, Dana. So then I worked for a little bit in community sectors, mostly in grassroots nonprofits. And I realized that there was an opportunity to really communicate better with the people who are funding the work that we did. And I went back to school and did a master's in public policy. And I went to school in Vancouver at Simon Fraser University. And so that was like 2008 to 2010. And then I started working, and it's funny because at the time I did not realize that I was working in evaluation. And then I ended up years later in like 2015, I think it was, around 2015 was my first true evaluation role. And I was doing some research and found work that I had done in 2009 through, actually, I listened to one of your episodes with Community Foundation of St. John. And so it was through Community Foundations of Canada. I did this project called Building Community Vitality. And a big section of it was on outcome measurement. And I like completely forgot that I did that. But I realized when I found that, I started reflecting on my path. And, you know, I think they actually talked in that episode about how it's really a lot about curiosity, mm-hmm. and that I was curious and I felt like there were better ways to tell the story of the work that we did. And so I took opportunities to like volunteer for logic model working groups and things like that really, really early on in my career without realizing what it was leading to. So as I started coming into more true evaluation roles, I realized that, you know, there's a lot of information out there. I think as someone who was, you know, an accidental evaluator, I had a lot of opportunity for self-teaching. Better evaluation is an amazing resource. So being able to learn a lot. But then I also wanted to be able to contribute to the body of knowledge around evaluation. And I found myself, you know, wanting to get into research in a different way. And so that's where the PhD opportunity kind of started sparking. Mm-hmm. And I found the IDP at Western Michigan, and it just felt like really the right fit. You know, we talk about a lot of evaluation programs are within other schools or other faculties. And those never seemed really aligned for me. As soon as I saw this, and it's also fairly close, it's a couple hours away, right? So I thought, oh, I could probably do that and drive out there a couple times a week or whatever if I needed to. But then it was fully virtual, so it made it even easier to make the decision to jump in and get started. Yeah.
Yeah, that program definitely has the benefit of being truly an evaluation program, not housed in some other discipline. Like Claremont was psychology. A lot of them are in health or education programs. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to get really that they call it interdisciplinary, but perhaps even more transdisciplinary, like the way Scriven talks about it, approach to evaluation. So cool.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's been a really great opportunity to be able to go through that program and learn with and from all of the folks who I've met along the way. Now I'm in my last bit of coursework. And so I should be finished up my courses in June and then head toward comps and dissertation, which is feels like a whole new chapter of the PhD.
Yes, it will be. Yeah. I know a lot of people, once they get out of coursework, it's like that lack of structure, right, kind of goes away. And mm-hmm. so finding out how you can build the structure for yourself can really help with that. I'm curious, you want to talk? Do you want to respond to that?
I was just going to say, I think it'll be interesting for me because, so I also work and professionally I do independent consulting right now. And so to be used to the project management side of things. I'm curious to see if I also fall into like the challenges with the structure, or if it's something that comes more naturally to me because I've been doing it for longer.
Yeah. I mean, in one regard, yeah, you have the project management skills to do this. And also this is a just you, and there's not really, I don't know what your program's like, but there's not really a deadline in place, right? There's no, mm-hmm. like you have to have your proposal by this date, or you have to have your final dissertation by this date, except for the typical, you need to be done within 7 years type thing.
Yeah.
Right. And nobody wants to be spending that much time, but it happens. And so once it's like just you managing your own project by yourself, that's where like, you know, accountability groups can be really helpful, mm-hmm. right? So like, yeah. you know, reaching out to the other graduate students you're working with right now and just being like, can we just sit together and come together every couple of weeks? Actually, which reminds me, I think I've mentioned on the podcast a few times, but I'm part of a mastermind group, and I have been since I came here to UW Stout. But at the time I was the only one of my group who had graduated. Finished PhD, all that stuff. And so it was really for a long time, like we're getting our last group member out with her PhD, hopefully by the end of spring or summer, I think it is. And it's been so like helpful for having that space, that accountability support space to like help each other through the dissertation process and, you know, external reviewers and dealing with comments and getting feedback from each other, even on pockets of our writing and stuff. So one way that you could do it.
Yeah. Actually, Val Marshall, who I just mentioned, has an accountability group that I think is really active, and I haven't been able to join yet because I'm like, I don't need the accountability just yet. But it's nice to hear that you've been able to like maintain that over time too. So what happens when the last person graduates? Are you going to stay together as a group or what?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It's been 4 years and it's still this lovely space where we come together. Now it's about once a month. And we're at this point where we all just have these chaotic schedules. So even then, once a month has been challenging to find the time, mm-hmm. but I don't know. I think we'll figure that out when we get there. And also it's mostly just kind of this nice catch-up space. Cause I don't think the five of us really get together otherwise, right? Like mm-hmm. two of them are working together, so they see them each other all the time, but we don't see them and they don't see us nearly as much as I think we could if we were having this continue to be a space for us.
Right.
So I like it yeah. for that reason.
Oh, absolutely. It would be unfortunate to lose that because we hear so much about how connection is so important, right?
Yeah.
And I think in, you know, PhD programs, but even beyond, you, like you're saying, you know, you probably don't have people who are exactly interested in the same thing as you in your work life either, right?
In my current institution, not really. Yeah. And so like a lot of my identity has shifted towards being more teaching focused as opposed to evaluation focused, because I'm at a teaching focused university where with, you know, one of my colleagues leaving on to better places has left me being kind of the only evaluation person. There's a couple mm-hmm. people in like our institutional research office, but I don't get to see them nearly as often as well. So having that, you know, multiple communities of evaluation help, having this community of my past colleagues from Claremont help. And it's like, this has been the first time in my life that I have retained friendships past like moving on, you know, like I have like one friend that I routinely talk to from college. I have a couple that I message here and there from high school, and that's it. Right.
Yeah.
But here I am, I'm like in routine conversation with folks from Claremont, and like that there's something special to that.
Yeah. That is really cool. It's funny. Cause I had some friends over a couple of weeks ago, and they are, like you're saying, mostly from like high school, or I was in bands growing up. And so I know them through all of those places, and I've known them for so long. And I brought up a thing about the logic of evaluation and it just really didn't land with that group. So it must be nice to have a group that you can talk about that with.
Yeah. I try to bring it up in the one class I do on grading practices with, because I've written a couple blog posts about this, how I think the practice of ungrading can be very supported by using a logic of evaluation approach. Mm-hmm. 'Cause otherwise it's just like, figure it out how to grade yourself. And like, it's just like asking people, figure it out how to evaluate yourself. Like,
right.
You know, nobody's trained in how to do that. Let alone, I will say, teachers aren't necessarily trained in how to evaluate their courses, right? Mm-hmm. Or evaluate their pedagogy, or evaluate the extent to which students have met the criteria of the course, right? Mm-hmm. That's why we get these courses where it's like, here's your assignments. You just get the grade you're going to get. And that's the final grade, right? And it's like, well, this is why alternative grading practices are coming about, because now we're like, that's really just in the assignments are, yes, hopefully helping address the learning objectives. Like a really well done course will do that. And yeah. also completing an assignment doesn't necessarily mean you've met the learning objective, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And so like, are these the other, like, what other ways can we capture meeting of the learning objectives, AKA meeting the outcomes of interest of your course, right? And yeah. so I see all these parallels, and so I try to bring them in as much as possible, but I know some people get real frustrated with me. It's just like, oh, here she is again, talking about eval.
But it is, you know, transdisciplinary. It is everywhere, and it can be applied to so many things for improvement.
Yes. So. Yeah. I try so hard to make that argument. And also it is so struggling because I've been in various other groups that don't know about evaluation as a field, as a profession, mm-hmm. right? And I've personally been just struggling so hard with communicating evaluation in a way that doesn't come off as being like, you don't know evaluation, you know, because in many regards, I don't think they do, because they don't recognize us as a profession, and therefore they just think it's a method, and they don't see how it's this value-driven approach that we're doing values inquiry and, you know, making a value judgment that's the core of doing evaluation, or at least I believe that is, right? Mm-hmm. That is the case. And other people don't necessarily think that. And then, so like when I'm trying to say that, it can come off a little abrasive of like, oh, you're invalidating my definition of evaluation. I'm like, ooh, okay.
Because I think for, at least from my experience, a lot of times those definitions of evaluation coming from people who are trained as like social science methodologists tend to actually avoid the value judgment piece.
Of course.
Right. Yeah. Because they're trying to like not introduce bias. And here we are like, it's all biased. Just, you know, acknowledge it and be explicit and intentional about what you're doing with it.
Yep. Well, because like even researchers are making value judgments. They're making mm-hmm. value judgments in the topics of inquiry, in the analyses they choose to do, and who they decide to just get data from, and how they go about publishing their work, and how they bring people in and not. Like there's so many value judgments, and you know, we could call it bias, we could call that objectivity, whatever we want to call it, but you know, it's there in everything we do, even at the very basic level of a p-value. It's a value judgment. We have determined 5% alpha rate is the value that we are good with. Sometimes we go down to 1% or 5.5% or whatever. But that's a value judgment, right?
Exactly.
And how did
made
we
a
come
decision
to that?
And it has implications. So
yes, exactly. We'll get off that soapbox. I could go on for days on that.
Well, but it's funny, and to bring up, you know, how you can communicate with people about evaluation in a way that feels like non-confrontational, because the situation that I was talking about where I brought up the logic of evaluation, I'm working on a project with a colleague who's lovely, and we had really been struggling with how we're presenting this. It's a review of local social services. And one night, in the middle of the night, I woke up and went, I haven't applied the logic of evaluation to this project. And I'm telling you, Dana, this has been like 4 months of working on it. And just like, I called it wrestling an alligator. Like we have been grappling with this and having such a hard time of getting something that we could present, because we didn't have the criteria and standards that were going to allow us to synthesize this information to present it to people to make decisions. And as soon as we did that, it all fell together. But I was really, I don't know if anxious is the right word, but I was cautious about presenting it, because I didn't want to be like, well, I'm doing my PhD in evaluation, so I know the logic of evaluation. And, you know,
right.
I didn't want to be like heavy handed with it. So it is something that you kind of dance a little bit when you have some knowledge that you want to share.
Yeah. And in what you just described reminds me of the paper that came out, a few years ago on the extent to which people understand and use the logic of evaluation in their practice. Mm-hmm. And when you realize that most people, one, don't know about it, or two, are really applying it, like, you know, if that's kind of the underpinning of how to do evaluation, this basic process, logical process of doing evaluation, then like, not understanding like that you need to set criteria and the standards for those criteria can be really, I don't know, tough for people to chew on, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because people have their ideas about ways of doing evaluation. And I think that's part of the field, right? That people come into it from so many different ways. And so to say like, this is the way, even though it's so flexible and it provides you with, you know, so like I'm a convert, so I'm here. It is something that I learned through the PhD, but I think it is something that can really support, just like the project I was talking about, it can really support your practice and your work. So,
Yeah. And I think maybe I wonder if like an approach of somebody writing a paper of showing how these various theoretical approaches or just like methodological approaches to evaluation like is using the logic of evaluation just in different kind of ways, right? Mm-hmm. Like how does a participatory evaluation help support the logic of evaluation? How might you use it within a participatory approach or within a social justice type approach or feminist evaluation approach, right? Maybe seeing that a little bit more explicitly could help people realize that I think people are doing it. It's just, they're not calling it criteria. They're not calling them standards. They're not calling what they're doing, making a value judgment, or it's like, whose role is it to do that? Well, not always the evaluator, right? I think a lot of people believe that it's the client's responsibility, but to what extent are we facilitating that approach? Like there's all these different ways we could do all of this. Just like there's so many different synthesis methods and so many different criteria and all this stuff. And it's just a matter of like, how do we apply it in these various theoretical approaches?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be a really useful piece of research that someone can do. So
yeah. Hint for some of our listeners.
Right. Add it to the list. Yeah.
I know. So many things to work on. So speaking of research and things to do, do you want to talk a little bit about your ideas for your dissertation? Because I know we've talked briefly about it in the past, but it's been a while.
Sure. Yeah, it has been a while. And when we spoke, I was thinking about interpersonal skills, and I still am. I'm thinking about, you know, like I said, my interest is really around evaluation capacity building, and partially like the why that I believe that as we create learning organizations, they have the opportunity then to influence systems, and, you know, to change the systems that they work in to really, you know, enhance social justice, or, you know, to make conditions better for the folks that they support. And I find often the organizations that I work with anyway, the barrier is really time and the, you know, the ability to focus on those kinds of things that feel like they have to be done off the side of the desk, you know? And so I'm thinking a lot about how evaluators build relationships with those organizations, maybe, and the approaches that might be used. You know, you mentioned feminist evaluation, and that's something that's been on my mind a lot as well. And then some of the things that I really haven't delved too much into, but ideas around like cognitive kindness and relationship management, and how evaluators use all of the different skills from those without being explicit about it. And I think the conversations that we've had is like, if we can be a little bit more explicit about it, first, we can question them, so we can make sure that we're actually valuing the right skills. And we can also do a better job of teaching them. Because we know what, like, you know, what are you trying to do? I think it's such a risk to send evaluators out into the world and say, like, you figure out the practical part as you go, like the interpersonal and the relational and, you know, situational parts as you go. Because, I think it just sets a lot of people up for tough situations.
Yeah. Yeah. This is totally reminding me of kind of what I was hoping to do as follow-up to my dissertation work. I don't think I'll ever get to it, but my dissertation was looking at how important relationship factors are to the evaluation process, use specifically, process, instrumental, and conceptual use. And of course, found that interpersonal skills, relationships in particular, are really important to that use finding, right? Mm-hmm. But the question then became like, well, how do people do that? How are people building those relationship skills? And this is coming from me being this, like I've been teaching interpersonal skills, this course for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years now, and I love it to pieces. And also I still feel like I'm learning. And especially 4 or 5 years ago, you know, when I was finishing up my dissertation, I didn't feel like I was good at it. Like I was constantly trying to figure out how to be better at this because I recognized the importance. And I just thought, naively, that it was just this innate skill that you either got or you don't. And so I tried to, you know, try this observational learning with the mentors that I was working with, who I had admired for their interpersonal skills. But that wasn't enough. It helped a little bit, but it wasn't enough. Having the concrete skills and the knowledge behind what these are really helps. And so like, I feel more cognitively aware of what is happening in a dynamic situation than before. I didn't have the words for it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is, you know, the risk of what's happened is that people have come through and just without reflecting, and maybe they have reflected personally, but without sharing their reflections, they have not, you know, they make it feel like they know what to do. Like they just know, and that there are no, you know, steps that you can take to build that. And I think being able to bring people along and create opportunities for people to gain those skills and to practice them in safe ways is really important. And, you know, I come from like a social work background. So I think that's part of it too, is being able to recognize how I learned skills in other programs, in other fields, that might be able to translate.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause this is one area that I don't think the field of evaluation is going to be the main entry point, right? Like we talk about the importance, they're part of our competencies. And also I would go to the communication field, in regards to like how to learn about good interpersonal effectiveness. Like they routinely have courses on that topic as part of their major degree programs. You know, the business world is also often thinking about it and talking about it a lot more concretely than I think we are. You're right. It feels like this amorphous, like it's just like contextual situationalness, right? Like, you'll just know it. It's like, oh, but how?
But how you don't. Do this? And how do you know that what you know is the right thing to know? I think, it's, you know, the contextual piece is really important to me too, because part of that relationship management is like appreciating the demands that are on the evaluands or the organizations that we work with. Yes. Right. And not coming in as like, this is the way we do evaluation and it has to go on this timeline and with this process. Because working in really like small to medium sized nonprofits, like it is tumultuous there. Yeah. And, you know, to be able to kind of weave in and out at the right times, can really, I think, be an important skill for evaluators to have. But it's hard, especially when we have our own timelines too, right? But even to know, like I've had success in the past where I've come and say, hey, you know, I can see that this is going on right now. We can, like, I'm okay with extending this timeline by 2 months if you're also okay with it, you know, to know that there's like a negotiation that can happen throughout the process. Yeah. And not be afraid to address that.
Just reminds me of the importance of that reflective practice, right? That it's not just make a plan, do the plan, you're done, but you have to constantly reflect on that plan and find out if this is still working right, or if you need to really shift things around or completely shift it all around and find what works for particular individuals. Cause you know, there's one thing, like we have like, I don't know, a 5-step approach to this particular method or whatever it might be. And most methods have kind of some situationality that, you know, they know that there's contextual factors to consider, and yet there's still kind of an algorithm that you follow, right? A methodological approach. And this doesn't, right? Like you might be like, okay, this is how I'm going to always do my intro meetings. And then you come to a particular organization, you're like, ooh, this is not going to work, right?
Yeah.
There's just, you needed the toolbox and know which tools to pull, but you can't just be like, okay, I always use this tool first and this tool second and this tool third. And if I need to, I'll do tool four, right? It just doesn't ever work that way.
Sometimes you got to start with tool four. So
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. That was one of the things about the ECB case competition that we did last year that they brought forward was the case site. They went in to do an assessment with them, and they realized that like the language in the assessment was not familiar to the folks that they were trying to assess. Right. And so you really have to be able to then think on your feet and say, okay, what information do we need from this group, and how can we gather it in a way that doesn't, like, yeah, that doesn't require that level of knowledge.
Yeah. 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 That translational work type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what are your next steps in terms of, it sounds like you finish coursework in June and then comps, what do your comps look like?
So our comps are, and this is, you know, the IDP is no longer accepting students. I don't know if you know that, but, so for my comps and the few people who will be continuing through the program, are three parts. The first part is a portfolio and the second part is an oral, presentation of a piece of, research on evaluation. And then the final part is a full oral, like, comprehensive exam. So that's what that looks like. It's over a week. So it's something to prepare for. So I'll spend the summer preparing and plan to do those in the fall. As I'm, you know, figuring out my dissertation topic. So I actually, you know, we have a seminar course right now and we're learning about, or we're reading the book Destination Dissertation as part of that course. And so they talk about having a conceptual partner. So I actually have a meeting next week with someone who I've chosen as a conceptual partner, who's, you know, she recently finished her PhD in social work. And when I was thinking about applying, I had a conversation with her about her experience and what I was thinking. And she said, you know, Allison, you really have to like research if you're going to do a PhD. And then she laughed. You mentioned your dissertation because we were actually working together on a research public partnership at the time. So working at an organization. And then she laughed and said, no, I know you, you do like research. So it's a good fit. So that's what I have that coming up next week. So I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
That's exciting. A conceptual partner. That sounds like a really helpful person to have on your side while you go through this process.
I hope so. You know what? And I don't know if you've read the book, but it's very, like speaking of your structures and steps, it really gives you the structure and steps, which I think you can then obviously have to adapt to your own needs, but it's good to give you like a nice framework. And so they actually have a list of questions that your conceptual partner should ask you, like set up a meeting and have this conversation. So I'm really looking forward to that. Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. If I had a book to help me with my thesis and dissertation, I do not recall having a book. And so I felt like it was a lot of figure it out and kind of dependent on your mentor and how their approach was. And yeah, I feel like having a really helpful structured book can really help navigate people through that process, especially because like, I'm sure my mentors never got such a book or had any mentorship on how to do this, right? So we're all figuring it out as we go.
Exactly. So I'm really grateful that somebody wrote it down.
Right.
And gives you the chance to learn from theirs. You know, like I said, obviously you're going to make it your own and your process is going to depend on your life. But it's at least gives you an idea of what it might look like.
Yeah. So you're getting your PhD right now, you're taking coursework, you're living in a different country, albeit like you said, a few hours away. So not too bad, but you also have your own consulting business, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you have a family. And so how are you doing all of this?
Yeah, I have three kids. So my youngest I actually had during the PhD, which was funny doing it virtually because I finished the term in April of 2022 and people were talking about what they're going to do over the summer. And I was like, oh, I'm having a baby. because people didn't see me that much. So
you only see it from like chest upwards, right?
Exactly. So it was not visible before then. So I have three young kids. The oldest is six. So it's busy to have all of them. And they often make appearances in my classes and things like that. But you know what? My mom went back to school when I was a kid, when I was nine. Mm. She was a hairdresser and she went back to school and became a nurse. And so it's just something that I saw when I grew up. And I think it also inspired me to like, to get an education and to continue my education was, seeing her do that. And so when I thought about applying for the PhD and thought, well, maybe I should wait until they're older or, you know, maybe there's never a perfect time, right?
Just like with having kids, right? Like there's never gonna be a perfect time.
Yeah. So for me, I was like, you know what, I'm going to do it. And if my kids see me doing classes and like taking that kind of time for myself, then maybe it will inspire them in the future to mm-hmm. pursue their dreams as well.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm hopeful about that. Although they are very excited. The two older girls are very excited to know that I will be done classes soon because we do, most of our classes are in the evening. It does yeah. take a little bit of time away from them, but you know, you can't be a mom full time. You can't be 100% of the time the mom to them. So, and you know, I have support around here with them from family and things. So it's that's helps. And then, yeah, I do the consulting thing as well, which actually just went to full time in June of this
congrats.
Year. So it had been thanks. Yeah, it had been something I was doing kind of off the side. I always had part or full time work. Usually as an evaluator within organizations. And then after my last son, I'm in Canada. So we have like a beautiful year-long mat leave, 18 months if you make that choice. But oh, wow. I took a year. Yeah, I took a year. And so then after him, I decided to go into the consulting full-time. And it's been really great. Just like we were talking about with connections, I've been able to make some really strong connections with in one case, a nonprofit organization that I really like, who are also consultants, but they created this nonprofit to continue an approach. They use called the Sustainable Livelihoods Framework, and so as they near the end of their careers, they've brought on associates to help continue keep life to this work. It's like a holistic asset based approach to organizational learning and evaluation and client coaching. So I've had opportunities through them and then with some other folks locally here that I've been able to connect with. And it's just, yeah, I think that helps the independent consulting piece is to keep connections and relationships. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you a member of CES and AEA?
I am a joint member. Yes.
Yeah.
So planning to go out to CES in May there in Fredericton. So I will be there. I'll actually be doing a presentation on organizational change and evaluation and what the literature says about both. So,
oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty excited about that.
Is this work that will help inform your dissertation, you think?
I hope so. Yeah. So in the IDP, we've been able to take courses in what's called our cognate area. That's not familiar language in Canada, but I think it's familiar in the US. I don't know.
Maybe not.
Yeah, like a specialization, a focus area, yeah. Kind of. And so my master's was in public policy. So that's a component of it. But then I've also been taking courses in the organizational change leadership program there at WMU, which I think really ties well with evaluation capacity building. And there are already folks who are doing work in both of those areas. So it's nice to be able to learn from their work and then build on that as well. So
yeah,
that's
exciting.
I think one of the things I love about that program and the courses that I've taken so far, my last course was on large scale change, and it was from a woman named Deborah Rocky. And she's wonderful. And a lot of what we learned about was around what they call dialogic organizational design or dialogic organizational change. So from the old way of doing things that was more diagnostic and just like evaluation, right? Like I come in and tell you what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong and give you a path to fix it. The dialogic approach is a lot more interactive and like understands the context, right? And so we're going to work together to figure out how things are working in your context and how they might be able to be improved, and focus on alignment as well and making sure that we're bringing everyone along with us instead of this top-down approach, being able to get everyone in the organization engaged and, you know, participating in the process. So yeah, I feel like there's a lot of good parallels.
So in terms of dialogic, it's like having a dialogue-based approach?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's that, kind of back and forth interactive.
Yeah. Participatory, right?
Exactly.
Everybody involved. Yeah. Which, reminds me, I have a colleague who's working on some consulting project, and the people who hired her just thought this would be this easy top-down approach. And first meeting with the, non-top management, right? So like mid-tier staff went horribly because they were not on board. And it's just like, so honestly, in some ways disrespectful that they put my colleague in that position. When I think they knew things were going on, but they thought their approach was going to be appropriate. And it's just like, dialogue is important.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And understanding, you know, that's why we talk about situational awareness, right? Like understanding what's going on within the organization, but that's it, right? Like that so many evaluators come into a organization and you don't know and then your colleague was in the room and had to try to think on their feet to be able to respond to what was happening, right? It's scary.
Well, and thought they were prepared because a needs assessment had been done, not by them, really tried to approach it using that needs assessment and thought like it was fine. And then to come in and be like, oh, no, it wasn't. Like, you know, we take all these things to be, you know, face value and just assume that like, okay, they have this data, you know, they tell us they have this data, or we see that they have this data, let's look at it. Okay, it looks good. But is it accurate? Is it valid? Is it reliable? Is it still valid, you know, months later, years later type thing? So, so many situational factors to consider.
Yeah. I have a friend who I've done some work with, and she uses, like, she'll ask in the kickoff meeting, you know, what are the potential things that could like go off the rails? Like, what are you, what do you see as things that are like, if I say this or do this, it's going to be a big problem. And, you know, I think at least it like sometimes might get it, but I think often either people don't acknowledge it or they may not even be aware of it. So it doesn't solve all your problems, but at least asking gives people the chance to speak up.
Yeah. Yeah. Those hypotheticals early on are really helpful. Also just to get people prepared for them to happen, you know, like, it may not happen, but if it does, at least we've talked through it and kind of recognize that this is a possibility. Yeah. Kind of reminds me of like Patton's utilization focused approach and how those conversations should happen at the beginning of like, how are you going to use this? What would you do if you got negative findings from this evaluation? And gets people to really like recognize that just because they think their program works doesn't necessarily mean the evaluation is going to find that, right? And get them mentally prepared for that result, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I know. It's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm wondering, what else would you like to talk about while we're here on this podcast episode together?
I don't know. I can say something if you want about attending conferences with a baby.
Oh, heck yeah.
That is helpful for people.
I got to meet your baby last year.
Yeah, you got to meet him at AEA last year. Yeah. So he has been now to 3 evaluation conferences and a feminist entrepreneurship summit. So he's not 2 yet. He will be 2 in June. And so he's a bit of a traveler.
And future academic.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, and how many classes he sat through with me. Like, I keep joking that if he doesn't become an evaluator, it's a missed opportunity, but
nice.
Time will tell. There's a lot of generational evaluation teams, right? So
yes, we'll there are.
Yeah. But so it's an interesting thing to attend a conference with a baby. And maybe like, I'll give a couple tips of like, please, you know, if you're able to bring someone with you, that's super helpful, but also like not be afraid to ask for help. I had so many people, I think my first year, he was a little bit sick. He got sick while we were there at AEA. And he was very little, like 4 months old. So I didn't really take up the help that was offered to me, where people like offered to hold him or whatever. And so definitely do that, but also like just being really gracious with yourself. I think AEA, we've talked about how overwhelming AEA can be for anyone.
It's a lot.
Yeah. So if you're traveling with another person who you're like keeping alive, then recognizing that you can't do it all and being comfortable with that. And I think, you know, that's something that is a challenge that I've like experienced as a PhD student, is seeing other PhD students who don't have that extra like baggage, I guess, be able to interact with people in ways that I wasn't, because I was like, I got to get back to my room and feed this kid, you know, or whatever it is, right? So but recognizing that that's something that that, you know, you can do if you want to, you don't have to. I think sometimes, especially in the evaluation field, we think that if you don't attend the conference, then you're like going to miss out and the opportunities are no longer there, but they are. There are other ways to connect with people as well. And so, you know, just like making the right choices for yourself and for your family, I think is important. It can be done.
Well, and having been to the conference now, for this will be my 10th conference this year. I'm very excited for it.
Oh, well.
I've seen a lot of people bring their children, babies and upwards, right? And I cannot speak for everybody, but I just get the sense that it just feels kind of normal. Like, okay, there's a kid in the room. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Or, oh, somebody's brought a baby and the baby just start crying. Like, okay. Like it just is what it is. It's part of natural human life. Especially now after COVID, I think we're a lot more, cognizant and, supportive of how much our personal lives should really not be distinct from our professional lives in that regard. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, yeah, it's just recognizing, yeah, that you can, you know, still fully participate in something with this other part of your personal life. Like they're so connected. It's, you're a whole person and yeah. It's impossible to separate. I can say at the last conference that Corey Whitmore was like such a wonderful support, and like right away walked up to me and said, oh, I brought my babies to a conference. And so, you know, the evaluation field, I think, is just so many lovely people with, such great approaches and really, yeah, open to supporting and connecting and helping people get through things like that. So
yeah, well, I don't know if you noticed, but at the last conference, a doctoral student who I believe has just now defended their dissertation, so congratulations, came to the conference with triplets.
Yes,
baby triplets, right? And managed to. I saw them all over the place. So apparently had some decent experience at the conference, right?
Yes.
And finished their PhD with triplets. Like, oh my
goodness. So amazing. I know. Yeah.
I can't it's even really imagine.
Cool. Yeah. Absolutely. It's so neat to get to see, people doing things like that. And, you know, we all, I think, reinforce each other too, to be like, okay, she's doing it with triplets. Well, I only got one kid. I can handle this, right? And I heard that a lot last year. Folks who came the previous year saw me with the baby and said, I brought my baby this year. You know, like I didn't have to separate myself from that part of my life.
Yeah.
Because I realized that it could be done. Yeah.
But I think making it a bit more of a norm for the conference and continue, like more people bringing their children along, perhaps we can get to a point where we could have childcare at the conference.
I will say I had a lovely, so I went to the city of Winnipeg in Manitoba, Canada, and I had this conference there, and they had a service, which was basically like childcare for hire. And so they vet all of the childcare providers. It's called Spoonful of Sugar. Mm. And you go through them. It's a small business. You go through them. They've done all of the, you know, background checks and reference checks and things. And they've got this team of childcare providers who they can send out. And so I was able to hire someone through them. So there are different ways of doing it that aren't, because it's hard to like just at a conference have childcare, right? If you don't have the volume, but ways that we can try to figure out together how we might be able to support families more to participate.
Yeah, especially because then you're not paying for your partner to join you, right? For example, which, you know, airfare is primarily the big thing, at least, right? Because you can split a hotel room, presumably. Having somebody there locally sounds like a really great solution to
it was a cool solution. Yeah. I've heard sometimes hotels can help with it too. And I mean, the partner thing is only realistic for some people too, right? For me, I have two other kids. So unless I'm bringing the whole family, which then airfare becomes a whole situation, then you know, someone has to watch them too. So
yeah, we just need the conference to be in Michigan and then you can just drive down. You're good.
There you go. Hey, Indianapolis was not bad. I was able to drive there. So
very good. Very good. Yeah I ended up flying that one, but I kind of wish I had just driven it. Would have been, I think it was like going to be a 10-hour drive. So
that's a good horrible, drive.
But not great.
Mine was like 5. So it's easily one day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I get to see you in Portland this year.
I'm hoping to go to Portland. Yeah. I haven't booked anything yet, but
it's a little early.
It is. Yes. But I mean, the proposals are due soon. So we'll see if I get something together for that. It's hard to juggle all the like PhD stuff, work, and then other calls for things that come out. So sometimes I do miss those chances. But
at least our proposal process, I think, is a little easier than some conferences. Like AERA, it's you have to submit a, you know, I don't know, 20-page paper.
Oh my goodness.
And it's like 10, 11 months prior to the conference that you submit this paper.
Wow.
Yeah, it's I don't remember, it's 20 pages. It's been a while since I submitted there, but it's a lot of labor to hopefully get accepted, right? At least this is a page, 2 pages.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 It's not too onerous. So.
Yeah. Well, anything else you want to share before we head off?
I don't think so. No, it's been so lovely to chat with you.
Yeah. It's nice to catch up and hear about babies and conferences and dissertation work and getting through this crazy thing called a PhD. So I'm so glad we could catch up.
Yes, me too.
Cool. As we wrap up, are there anything, words. How should any listeners get in contact with you if they'd like to discuss anything with you further?
Probably LinkedIn is the easiest way. Just my name, Allison Prayer on LinkedIn. Yep.
I will be sure to put that in the show notes so folks can find you there.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah. Thank you, Dana.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please visit the podcast website at evaluland.fireside.fm, where you can subscribe to get notified of new episodes and contact us with your questions, comments, or suggestions. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, this has been Evaluland.